Hello, I'm Rory McKiernan, author of Hitching for Hope and host of the Love and Courage podcast. And you're very welcome to this, the Creative Souls of Clare podcast. We have a great episode coming up for you in just a moment. And before we get started, can I encourage you, when you're finished this episode, be sure to check out the archives of this podcast. There are some great conversations waiting there for you. And a big thanks to all of you who support the podcast in different ways and to Creative Ireland Clare for their great support. My guest in this episode is Deirdre Devalley. Ennis-based Deirdre is a writer of poetry, prose and songs. Deirdre has been published extensively and has a very strong and clear voice on social issues, as you'll hear shortly. She's had a fascinating journey along the way, including 2 years in a Buddhist monastery in LA. We talk about this and so much more in this fascinating chat. So without further ado, let's jump in and get started with this Creative Souls of Clare conversation with Deirdre Devalley. Deirdre, you're very, very welcome to the podcast. How are you keeping today?
Good, thanks, Rory. Lovely to meet you.
I'm looking forward to the chat here. And Deirdre, you're another one of those folk from Clare that lives in Clare that maybe doesn't have a Clare accent, in so far as maybe I don't also, but you're very much a Clare person in that you've hit the 2 decades mark here. So I think you get some kind of a badge at that point, do you?
Actually, Rory, I think I got the badge after 4 years because 4 years. I was told, yes, and it was actually Davy Spillane who told me when I moved out to Lisdoonvarna from Dublin initially. Yeah. And Davy said to me, if you can make it through 4 winters in North Clare, you'll stay.
Fair enough. Yeah, they're 4 winters in Lisdoon rather than Ennis. I consider the Ennis to be on the sunny side. Yeah. There was actually one day I went to Ennis for the sunshine because I'm not joking. Yeah, the forecast was actually different than Lahinch, like by 3 to 4 degrees or something. It was mad.
Oh, I will believe it. There are microclimates, and even I didn't stay out in Lisdoonvarna too long, but even between Lisdoonvarna and Ballyvaughan, there could be a change of climate just going down Corkscrew Hill. Yeah.
We shouldn't be telling everyone about the Costa del Ennis. It'll spoil the place.
Yeah.
Everyone thinks Lahinch is the hotspot, but it's really Ennis.
It's Ennis.
Yeah. So what did draw you to Ennis in the first place?
Well, I was well settled in Dublin. You know, I had my life well established there, and my mother died 22 years ago, and I came to visit Clare. Friends invited me to a cottage they'd rented in Ballyvaughan for New Year. My mum died at Christmas, so they invited me for New Year, and I came down and I can honestly say the only way I can describe it is spirit, because I went out to the Poona Brón Dolmen, and I could just feel spirit everywhere. And I could feel my mum very strongly there. Although, you know, we'd never actually been to Clare. I'd never been to Clare in my life. But somehow I found myself over the next year. There was just a sort of a series of coincidences where a couple of friends moved to Lisdoonvarna, a couple. And I visited them. And then they had been renting that house. Then they were buying in Doolin. So that house became available. And it just happened.
All fell into place. Yeah. And is that a sort of a modus that you tend to embrace, that sort of letting it happen kind of thing?
Yes, a lot of the time. I mean, I can still get caught up in making decisions and anxiety and whatever. But sometimes when things just flow, even though I had no intention of moving in a particular direction,
yeah,
physically or emotionally or whatever, if something just flows, I try and go with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, I hear you. And so then, like, just maybe going back to the Dublin years for a while, can you talk to me about, like, life growing up in Dublin, and particularly then, were there elements of creativity in your early life? I mean, to be honest, most children are creative. You know, we seem to be born creative. We get the colouring pens out and we sing songs or write poems or whatever. But then at some point in people's lives, maybe a little bit more kicks in and they really take to the stage, or they take to to the guitar or whatever. Was there any element to that in your life?
I suppose the biggest influence, there were two really big influences. My grandmother, my mother's mother, emigrated to New York when she was 55, when her husband had died and her children had just grown up. My wow. Nana, she took off.
Wow.
Yes. She went to visit, or she went to live with her two older sisters who had left, you know, when she was a very small baby. And whenever Nana came home, whenever she came home, there would be concerts in the house. She was a wonderful singer. And my grandmother, she and her husband and my mother's siblings had all taken part in the operettas in Mullingar. So they were all singers, except my poor mother, the only one of seven siblings. She was the one most likely to want to stand up and sing, but she really hadn't a note in her head.
Oh.
Yeah, it was kind of tough, but she really encouraged us. So when my grandmother came home to visit, we thought of her as our American millionaire granny. Well, Nana, she wouldn't tolerate granny. It was too old.
Yeah.
But so we would stand in front of the sliding doors in the living room. You know, the kids would be lined up and we would sing. And that became just very natural. And then my dad was quite a shy person, quite an introvert, but he was a reader and working class Dubliner, who dad had gone to college for a couple of years, but a family emergency pulled him out and he never made it back. But dad was a reader and he had a tremendous intellect and a gift with words. And my dad could talk on any subject under the sun, and I really mean that, pretty much anything. But he would quote Shakespeare, you know, as naturally as breathing. And I didn't even know it was happening when I was young. It was only when I got older, when I was walking down a supermarket aisle with him, and dad would come out with something that was relevant to something around us. Mm. And I think, oh my God, you know, that's Yeats or Keats or whoever. So that was there, although it was never pushed. It was just I grew up with it.
Wow, there's quite an amount going on there with the granny. And,
yeah.
Well, you yeah. know, like it sounds like there's a movie in that for a start. But
yes.
yeah. What decade was that she emigrated?
She emigrated before I was born in 1960. And as far as I know, she was gone. I only ever remember her
yeah.
coming
yeah.
home.
Well,
so the late 50s, I would think.
Right. It certainly speaks to a kind of a strong independent streak, you know, particularly as a single woman, essentially.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And she had been taken out of school. They lived on a small, tiny, small farm outside Mohill in Leitrim, my grandmother. And her mother died when she was eight, and she was taken out of school to run the household. Her older sisters had emigrated, and there were boys there, but she was the woman of the house. And really, if she'd been born, if she was my age in this era, she would have been running a multinational corporation. She had that kind of go in her.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got that sense from hearing about your father as well, you know, just the hands that you're dealt, like, you know, in the right opportunities in the right time, he would be the professor of this or that and running a department in UCD or wherever. You just don't know.
No, you really don't. And I suppose at times in life and in my own life, you something just happens that pulls you away from your passion. And then sometimes it's a choice where it may not be a choice you want to make, but you're choosing family, or, you know, you're choosing something with a higher weighting rather than your own passion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess it comes down to your values as well, you know,
yeah.
like that. If you know, most of us would like to say we choose family and we choose health and loved ones and so on. And so, and it's also, you know, those kind of judgments that perhaps, you know, it's a big loss, or he'd be better off as a professor in UCD, but maybe he wouldn't be. Maybe he'd be insufferable and also not available to his family or whatever. So
yes, yes,
it's not as black and white as that at all.
No, it's really not. It's not. And he ended up running a timber yard at one stage of his life in the Liberties in Dublin. And he loved that milieu. He loved, my dad was a Dub, but he loved that real Dublin culture and wit and just sort of being immersed in that. But he also, he loved working with timber and he loved trees. Mm. So through, you know, something that he gave us, my mum did too, but by my dad more so, was just sort of a deep love of nature. Mm. And I, you know, you just, I do wonder sometimes if his life had gone another direction, would we even have been born, me and my siblings, as we are? Because he probably wouldn't have met my mother. He may not have met her. You know,
well, these are all the sliding doors of...
Yeah.
I mean, it's no different in one sense of you going to Listenvarna and here you are, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, when you did move there, like there was a bit of coming and going though, wasn't there? I don't think you settled in Clare at that point, or was that the first arrival?
I settled in Point in Clare, Rory, except for 2 years. When I, you know, I've been in Clare.
Yeah, that's the bit I had in mind that you were abroad and you were okay as well. Yeah,
just for 2 years. I went 11 years ago to a Buddhist temple in LA and I stayed there for 2 years and I'm back 9 years, but I've been in Clare other than that. But I came upon that whole Buddhist scene. I'd always had an interest in it and, but there was a Buddhist centre in on the Quinn Road in Ennis when I moved here. And I had been, when I moved to Ennis from Listenvarna, and I had been extremely sick for 10 years, 11 years nearly, with a post-viral, post-flu scenario. And I was so ill. And I had heard of this centre on the Quinn Road where they did healing sessions, you know, spiritual healing. And I was really interested. And I'd also been doing meditation before that. But I went to a few sessions and then I met the abbot of the temple in LA. He was visiting this. It was part of his lineage, Hanmi Buddhism. And the instant I saw Dan Kendall, I just knew this is my spiritual teacher. And I had been looking for a spiritual guide of some kind for quite a while. And the instant I met him, I thought, yeah, this is him. So for two reasons I went to the temple. One was I signed up, I took vows and whatever. And I was involved in that for 7 or 8 years, or 9 actually. But also, the LA climate. I had been so sick, and it was constant lung infections. And we both, Dan, my teacher, and I both figured that the climate in LA would greatly help, along with me receiving healing sessions, healing every day in the temple for about 2 months. And I really don't know which helped, did the trick, but something certainly, something worked. And I really loved it. I loved being part of that community. And I've let go of it very sadly in a way. But I'm just at a point in my life where I really don't want to be attached to any spiritual tradition as such. Just the self, and not in a selfish way. I love being part of communities and, you know, I'll go to other people's religious services or whatever, you know, if there's an occasion and I enjoy it. And but yeah, let go of it at that point when I came home.
Wow, that's very interesting. And did you ever sort of then go on to document that in any capacity? Did that influence any poetry or writing? Or
it did. I suppose it influenced some memoir stuff that I have been dabbling in over a number of years. But more than anything, actually, what it did, Rory, when I was there, I had begun researching Mary Magdalene and Christ and that whole huge area. And I while I was in LA, I got a copy of the Nag Hammadi Gospels, which were only discovered in 1945 and that are not considered kosher by the Vatican. But, you know, there's a tremendous amount of new information in the Nag Hammadi Gospels that show that really display Mary Magdalene or portray her as pretty much Christ, the spiritual equal of Christ. And I started working on that while I was at the temple, or I continued working on it, because I saw a huge similarity between the spiritual healing work that the monks were doing at the temple and the spiritual healing of Christ, which is something that was really not, I learned about it as a child growing up. I learned, you know, Jesus was a healer and he healed lepers, the blind, but I didn't see it. I didn't see that really in action in the Catholic Church, the sort of the hands-on healing. And when I saw it, when I saw the healing phenomenon that happened in the temple, it really, it actually clicked me into that whole area of Jesus and healing. So that was kind of what I worked on there. But I've put that aside for a while. I found it very difficult, I found it very painful researching that whole area for some reason. So it's left aside for now. Yeah,
well, it's a couple of thousand years of density.
Yes.
To put it mildly.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, and it's gendered.
Yes.
Yeah. So and is that something that you came to reflect on a lot, is being a woman in your own journey around, you know, your voice and finding your voice through poetry, or is gender irrelevant, or how do you feel about that?
I certainly don't think it's irrelevant. I don't think it's irrelevant. It would absolutely shape how I write and what I write about. I suppose nearly 20 years ago, I began, I did a year and a half of an MA in women's studies in UL. And that's, I got sick during the second year. So I just wasn't able to function. So I left it. But even when I went to UL, I got a lot of, there was quite a bit of reaction from people, not close friends, but just sort of acquaintances. Well, oh, you must be, you're a rabid feminist and whatever. And it really gave me pause for thought. And I learned a lot when I was there about the different forms of feminism. And today, I still think it's a wonderful word, but I really claim myself now as just an egalitarian. And I think in some ways, certainly in writing, in poetry, and where women's voices have been silenced, now the pendulum has swung significantly, in that it's really quite difficult for young men. And this was acknowledged by the lecturers on the course I've just finished, the MA in creative writing at UL, where it was explored how women are finding their voice. And I don't want it to be to the detriment of young men or old men, but I suppose it's just a natural balancing, redressing before things kind of settle again. But certainly in my writing, I would often write through humor, or sometimes in pure anger about women's issues, we'll say, or, you know, women being silenced or being abused, about cover-ups in particularly in the Catholic Church, it has to be said.
I suppose I was going to ask you any particular issues, but I mean, cover-ups speaks to a number of issues, doesn't it? Do you remember any particular case or issue that first kind of engaged or mobilized you?
It was probably back in the 80s when the scandal, sexual abuse scandal, started to emerge. I started writing. I wrote a letter to the papers, and I wrote a letter to the Gay Bar Now or whatever, and they were published or broadcast. And but I think it was really when the Brady Report came out, I just thought this is enough, you know, enough. And I wrote a letter to the Times. It was a very long letter, but it was published, and I got a lot of reaction back from that because my address was published. And so I got letters from a Garda sergeant who had been hampered, you know, in his investigations, and victims, and a priest who had been abused himself. And that really, I try to use the anger. I try not to write in anger because that can be very detrimental. I try to sort of sit with the anger and then channel it and use it. But I definitely have used it since. I try not to be vitriolic in if I'm writing about an issue. I think I get my message across by taking a somewhat softer approach. Recently, I sang at the Tuam Mother and Baby Home, the site of the Tuam Mother and Baby Home. It's the second time I've sung there, and it's an issue that hugely caught me. I think possibly because I'm not a mother, and not through choice, it's just the way my life went. And just the idea of how, you know, little babies and a number of mothers were discarded, or whatever word you want to use. And I wrote a poem. There was a headline that kept coming up in the media when this discovery was first made at Tuam, and it was significant quantities of human remains. And that stayed with me, and I wrote a poem from that. And one day, I didn't do anything with it. I think it was just for myself, just to exercise a bit. And I was driving in the car in Ennis. I actually remember where I was, and I was driving, and it wasn't in my mind, but suddenly lyrics were coming to me and a tune. And it was a song in the voice of one of the babies. And I pulled in and I started writing it down. So that developed. And I have to be very careful with this kind of stuff, Rory, because Kit Duval, one of my lecturers who's written an extraordinary memoir recently, Kit always says, don't dip your ink in another person's blood. And Kit is half Jamaican and half Irish. She would consider herself a black woman, and she's experienced a lot of prejudice in her life. But she talks about not using someone else's experience, you know, in too loose a way. So I was very careful with this song to try. And so I'm not speaking for the survivors. I thought I can speak for the voiceless. So that's what I did. And I sang it recently at a ceremony in Tuam. Yeah, I even get upset. I find it hard to sing the song, and sometimes I find it hard to even think about it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's there's a lot in it. Yeah, I actually have a family connection to the Tuam babies myself. So and I think at a lot of levels the Irish society is linked more than we know, because a lot of it's basically been hidden, and then like institutionally hidden, but then also hidden through shame. So
yeah,
it's only in recent years that we found out certain things as well.
Right.
As a family. So, still a lot of unfinished work going on. And I suppose that's traditionally one of the roles of the arts, to help shine light, essentially.
Yes.
And give voice to things that are voiceless.
Yes. Yeah.
And then put emotions into words that maybe are difficult to put into words.
Yes.
So, yeah. Yes. And there's something, something ritualistic about singing at the site, perhaps, as well. Do you know that, these children never had, we assume, by the looks of things, they never had any great love and care and possibly never had a funeral or anything like that, despite the proclaimed religion of the day. So to come back now all these years later, and I think, you know, I'm conscious they had a play on in Milltown Malby recently to remember the Raheen ambush, and there's still a lot of like history that requires attention.
Yes.
And the idea that history tends to, this idea that it belongs in a book and you close the book, but it's actually alive. And so
very much so. Yeah. I think the role of the arts, as well as, you know, holding up a mirror or bearing witness. One of the things that I like to do in my work as well, Rory, is humour. And it's, you know, it's to use humour. I don't mean with some of those deeply sensitive issues, but just in general, that it's particularly in the last couple of years, it's been such a heavy time. It's been a really difficult time. And we need to laugh as well. You know, we need that balance. We need that balance. And I sometimes I will write something and I think this is absolutely bloody ridiculous. But if I laugh when I'm writing it, and if other people get a kick from it, that's great too. Mm. You know, that's great too. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think it sort of brings some levity to it. The magnitude of the issues, they can be very dense, and just to kind of, comedy traditionally, you can kind of say it's just entertainment, but it's actually more so been used as a cultural and, I guess, a cultural force for change. That there's a lot of things can be said and explored through humour and comedy. I'm not saying you're a comedian, by the way.
But no, neither am I.
Yeah.
Neither am I. No. I just think some of my classmates at UL, you know, we wrote on various topics throughout the 2 years, but one person started a novel and it's very light, it's very funny. Mm. But there are some really serious issues running through it.
Yeah.
Like with some of the best writing, with Roddy Doyle or... We have tremendous writers here who have that capacity to marry both at times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big time. Absolutely. Yeah. So take me then from moving back to LA to back to Ireland. Like, how did you feel you'd changed then, and did your health stay good after that then?
It did, thank you. Yes, it pretty much did. That area of my health did, yes. It was very strange coming back. It was very strange. You know, I had lived in a very tight-knit community, and there's quite an illusion which I had myself before I was part of this community, that, you know, a Buddhist community is all sweetness and light. In the same way that I thought, you know, the monks in Glensdal, oh, what a lovely, you know, what a lovely way to live. You know, they're singing and they're gardening and they're teaching. And I learned that really the best way to get the corners knocked off you pretty damn quick is to live in a community like that, because people are just people. So when I came back, I was living on my own. I really have had about 9 years of having to move house. I've moved 8 times since I came back, which has been quite horrendous. And it has taken a lot of energy from my creative work, quite honestly. Mm. I'm now settled in a beautiful permanent home. But it was different, and I was changed. It's kind of hard to put words on. It definitely helped unblock my creativity, and it made me a lot more decisive. I had always had a meditation practice for some years before that, but a daily meditation practice really just helped with everything, I think. And I also changed the direction of my work, because I got back into work and I started teaching, facilitating the Artist's Way, 12 or 13 week course based on the book by Julia Cameron. And that was kind of life changing because you can't work closely with other people and not learn yourself, you know?
Yeah.
And I started teaching mindfulness. That was the other big thing, Rory. When I went away, there was no mention of mindfulness in Ireland. None, pretty much none. I came back and it had exploded. It was everywhere. And it was like, if you weren't doing mindfulness, you weren't hip. You weren't in, you know, where I think it's really become a wonderful, just part of mainstream. How would I say it? People are not just doing it now because it's good to do mindfulness. People are actually really practicing it, which is lovely.
Yeah, except not enough people are.
Yeah.
You know, I get what you're saying, but I often think, you know, because you do hear that, sure, everybody's at meditation, everyone's at mindfulness, but they're clearly not when you see the stress that's around.
And I'm not
for any second putting myself above anyone on that front, because I, you know, you forget yourself as much as anyone can. So, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's not something you just do and it's done. You know, it's like you have to keep doing it.
Yeah.
It's but it's also interesting then that you mentioned a lot about the church earlier as well. And obviously there's a clear secularization going on, but then there's clearly a need that's always going to be there and always was there, which is some form of innate spiritual need to find peace, inner peace, connection, so on and so forth.
Absolutely. And I think for me, I think part of the way I find it is group, you know, it being part of a group. So when I came back, one of the things I did was I joined the Poetry Collective in Ennis and the Ennis Creative Writers, Innish Creative Writers Group, which of course has been gone with COVID.
Yeah.
The wonderful Martin Vernon. I have to shout out to Martin Vernon here. He's one of my most wonderful friends, and he's just a very special person. And Martin kept the poetry going.
On Zoom, yeah.
On Zoom.
Yeah, I remember hearing that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And with international interest as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But for me, part of my spiritual journey is writing. And I suppose it's important to say as well, Rory, for anybody, you know, whoever is listening to this or will listen to this, I have a really big belief in taking away the mystique of creativity with the capital C. You know, it's that the notion, when I was growing up, you know, the notion of the creative person, I had the idea of, well, the starving artist in the garret or the drunken writer or, you know, the profligate musician or whatever it was. And really growing up, you know, I realize now that my mother was creative. She never thought she was. But she made Christmas and Easter, she made occasions utterly magical for us with very little money and whatever, but she made things magical.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way somebody sets a table, you know, somebody can have really enjoy setting a beautiful table for their family that doesn't cost money or, you know, but that's creativity. And we all need to be, you know, I like for everybody to know that we're all creative.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? No, you're spot on. And in essence, that's sort of the message I was hoping to impart with this podcast. But I've also fed the problem with the title of the podcast because I've singled out certain people as creative. So I'm feeding into kind of a prejudice or stereotype in a sense. But hopefully at the same time, dismantling it, we'll see. But it is a notion, is like you're either this or you're that, or, you know, you know, if you're an engineer, you're not a poet, but clearly there are people that are drawn to multiple disciplines and also that you don't need to be a professional anything, that, you know.
Yes. Yeah. And actually, I kind of realized that in Clare. I was at a creative circle in Glore recently, and Siobhan Mulcahy, the arts officer, was there, and she was saying what I thought was such a interesting comment that people in Clare don't even know they're creative because it's just born in the music and the dance and the storytelling. It's just so innate. They don't label it. You know, they just get on with it.
Yeah, that's actually that's a brilliant way of putting it. And yeah. You know, because we don't necessarily label other parts of yourself and say, oh, like those people are all empathetic and those people aren't. And in Clare, they're very empathetic, but they're not in Tipperary or whatever. Yeah. So it's just a component, but it's clearly a strong component here.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I think, you know, part of it is the different accents. And like, obviously there is a tradition here, but it also seems to be, and I'm open to being corrected, but it seems to be amplified by those that have also moved to the area to be part of that, to learn from it, and then also hopefully contribute to it. And like Martin Vernon's another example of that as well.
Yeah.
You know, there are people that put something in the pot, essentially, and actually more than something. Like you did rightly single him out there. He deserves a lot of credit and praise, and he does incredible work, and he's a very fine poet as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I think you're so right about that wonderful blending or co-nurturing of people coming into Clare and the people who've been here for generations. And on a wider scale, then, of course, the people who are coming into Ireland, you know, being welcomed and teaching us and us, you know, teaching them our traditions or our culture. And
that would be obviously, I mean, in various parts of Clare, like, the you know, well, you have lots of people from different countries around where I am, and but they could be surfers or all sorts, but then you've a 1,000-odd Ukrainian people fleeing a brutal war up in Listonvarna and Ballyvaughan, and then like Ennis is probably one of the more multicultural towns in the whole of Ireland. And
So it's
definitely not a sort of a complete monoculture here.
No, it's not. And I have to say, I love that. And my father was a very open-minded man. I was brought up in quite an unusual household for the era I was born into, because my dad was an agnostic, and my mother went to church in her latter years every day of the week except Sunday. You know, she went to the quiet little mass, but not on Sundays when everybody else was going. So it was a strange kind of an unusual mix for the time. But my father wanted to relinquish his citizenship about 4 years ago. He had such strong views on the inequities of direct provision and whatever, but he was so happy. It didn't happen, because I looked into it for him. It was actually a bureaucratic nightmare for him to kind of legitimately declare himself non-Irish.
He would become stateless.
Yes. He wanted to become stateless.
It's a tricky one, given
it's
that
it's very tricky.
It's in solidarity with people that are also looking for a state. But the sentiment is there. I think, like,
I think at the time the idea was he wanted me to sort of take it on as a project, because he wasn't able at that stage. But I think he just wanted to draw attention to direct provision and the
creative act of resistance. You know. Wow, that's pretty.
Yeah.
That's quite something.
Yeah. And that's back to ordinary people. You know, we're ordinary people, my family. We're just ordinary people. But it's amazing how people can take a stand in the most extraordinary of ways and have an impact without even realizing maybe what they're doing when they start something.
Yeah. No, you've definitely... there's something in that about your father. Like, maybe somebody listening will take that up and become stateless, or maybe it's not the best way of doing it, but
maybe not.
There could be like there's just something really interesting about that.
It
takes a certain degree of lateral thinking or something to come up with an idea like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, certainly direct vision is something I think we can't highlight enough. And,
No.
the fact that it's actually supposed to be dismantled and en route to ending within the next year and a half or two, and it's getting worse by the day.
It is.
Yeah. And because we talk about Tuam and Magdalen Laundries and all of that, but this is our modern equivalent. And
absolutely.
And we just cannot, we won't be able to say we didn't know about it. That's
no,
the thing.
No, for sure, for sure. And actually, in that, on that vein, I did write a short story when I was on the course. I did write a short story around direct provision. I didn't speak for the people in direct provision. I spoke as somebody on the outside, but it was completely fictional. And Joseph O'Connor, I'm pulling names here, but Joseph O'Connor was the course director, and he happened to mark this particular piece for me. And I got a critique back from him, but there was a line in it, and he said, "You're leaving yourself open to a massive lawsuit here," which I was. I won't go into any details, but it was based on, you know, something that actually happened in a direct provision centre. Where am I going with this? I'm losing my train of thought. Yes, I sent it to a couple of publishers, a couple of competitions, and I got some interesting critique back, but I got the sense that they were afraid to use it. You know, I've had quite a number of bits and pieces published. I don't have a book published yet, but I've had pieces published. It's very unusual for a competition or a literary magazine to actually send back feedback. But I just got the sense, because I amended it so that it is definitely not, I cannot open to slander or libel. But I think they're afraid to touch it. And that really, for me, just said, I just kind of think, oh, okay, that's interesting. We're not ready to go there.
Yeah, the thing is, so many of these centres are owned by private operators, and they're protecting their assets and their agendas. And then you have the government, the state protecting itself, and you've got the religious institutions protecting themselves, and now you have the publishers protecting themselves.
Yes.
So the whole world of solidarity just collapses because everyone's protecting themselves. Who's left to make a stand?
Exactly.
It does require I don't know how much courage it requires to publish a poem, because the sky isn't going to fall in on top of them. Like, if the lawyer approves it, you know, it's...
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. If the lawyer approves it. And there are very brave, you know, there are many brave publications out there who would. I suppose partly too, kind of coming back to the creative life, it's really... You kind of would need a PA to keep up with just the business side of writing. You know, to actually get your work, to send your work out, it can take, you know, an application can take a day, depending on what you're sending out. And sometimes I just don't have the time or the energy. I'd sooner save my energy for the work.
Yeah, no, you're touching
sending it out.
You're touching a sore spot here. Like, I spend half my week doing admin and stuff, and for a range of projects. But it feels increasingly that we're just all becoming administrators of something, and even your personal admin of between your tax and your NCT and your bits and bobs. You'd need everyone needs a PA at this point.
Absolutely, but on that point, I just wanted to mention the artist basic income, which I didn't get. I did apply for. I don't know of anybody, any friends locally who got it, but it is a step in, it's a step in the right direction. Mm. It's a step in the right direction because it's just so important. We saw it during COVID, you know, people and myself included were going back to really music, and people who never listened to poetry were listening to bits of poetry or reading bits of poetry, or just reading again, or Audible or whatever. So that idea of support the poet. I spent a week recently just two things that I was invited to take part in. And I was really happy to do it, delighted, privileged. Between the two things, it was a week's work for which I got nothing. And that, you know, but that, and I'm just saying that as in that's the reality for the creative life. Yeah.
Yeah, it often is, you know, it's the economic model is challenging. Well, particularly in poetry as well. Like, do you know, like, because if you're a musician, there are a number of routes to tread. You know, you can do the pub route, the wedding route. You can find a way of selling CDs at your album launch. And like, it's not straightforward at all, but certainly any kind of publishing, like even, you know, the very successful writers, they still end up having to get the day job or whatever. So it's
absolutely,
you know, but it's a tricky thing. And it's also like Lisbeth Gilbert talks about this idea of like putting pressure on your art to make a living out of it can also, you know, impede it as well. And that sometimes you're better off not relying on your art to pay the bills, because it's just putting too much pressure on it.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that.
Yeah, there's a lot in that, and the whole economics of art, I guess. But it's, and look, like, there's no singular way here, that everybody has their own way of working around this.
Absolutely. And I know Joe O'Connor, he always said to us from the start, you know, and he repeated it every now and then, that he would always advise a writer to have a job, to have, or you know, maybe if you weren't able for work or whatever, but to have another project, to not just be focused on the writing. Because, and I actually really find that, you know, I hope to get back to some bit of paid work after Christmas, but I've just been, it's been a very, very, very tough year. And I was just quite burnt out. And I had to make the decision of just no work, no paid work until after Christmas. But Joe always said, you know, you need something else. And I've always found that I had this notion that if I had great swathes of time, I would be so creative. But the reality for me always, my whole life has been, if I have nothing but time and a pen and paper, it ain't going to happen. Just won't happen. I need other stimulus, and I need to be giving as well.
Yeah,
you know, I need to be in service in some way.
Yeah, and you need kind of stimulus and fuel for the well and the fire to create the inspiration and so on.
Yeah.
Do you happen to have any poems to hand or anything, or any from memory there that you could?
I have nothing from memory, Rory. Okay. I know other people's work. I don't know my own work.
Wow.
That's kind of true of songs. Anyway, I have a short poem. This will be published in the Stony Thursday book, which is Anne-Marie Curran, wonderful editor, is editing it. It's coming out shortly, the anthology, but it's Spring of Life, and it's just connected to that idea of age and creativity and aging, you know, and not limiting oneself at any age to starting. So Spring of Life. I have been middle-aged for 20 years, having hit 40 19 years ago. I self-categorized as being in the spring of middle age, then summer and autumn of middle age, bypassing winter entirely. I am forced to acknowledge I have slid into spring of old age. I have known old 18-year-olds and young 80-year-olds. I will go down in a flaming red, full-length dress and flashy, dangly earrings. They will need to screw the coffin lid tight. Moonlight always makes me want to dance.
Oh, I love it. Love it. That's brilliant. That's great. It's it also speaks very clearly to age and creativity, and the idea that, you know, you're, well, going back to your granny at emigrating at 55 and your father, you know, prepared to do whatever he does at an older age. And there are some cultural assumptions that need smashing, I think.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So listen, thanks so much for the chat, Deirdre.
Thanks for having me. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, really enjoyed it. So
thanks, Rory.
And best of luck with all the many endeavours, and look forward to seeing your new work after this period of, refilling the well and tending to the flames and all that.
Thanks a million, Rory. Yeah. Lovely. Thank you.
Thanks again.
And good luck with your own work own writing. Bye-bye.
Hello, Rory McKiernan here again. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Creative Souls of Clare podcast. Please do consider sharing it amongst friends and people you think might be interested and help it get out into the world, reach more people. And don't forget to check out the archive for more great conversations. A big thanks also to Creative Ireland Clare for their support. And remember, I have another podcast you might enjoy. It's called the Love and Courage podcast. Some great conversations in there also. You can find me, Rory McKiernan, on various social media platforms and over at rorymckiernan.com. That's it, folks. Thanks for listening. Until next time.